will, digital data, where I've agreed upon on each of these four tones as the method of creating the equivalent of four wires. And each of those wires have a one or a zero. I say that is four bits of parallel digital data. I think that's digital, Barry. Over to you.
Okay, I can accept that. And the digits, if you will, if you want to call them that, those tones last a long time. Because I think one set of tones, you know, I think it sends in sequences of four tones, but the tones could be in any order. But there's four tones before they send one sequence. And the four tones together, I think that lasts well over a second. It's probably a couple of seconds.
I'm having trouble with that one, Barry. On the assumption that you are running a reasonable signal-to-noise ratio, minus 8 dB signal-to-noise ratio, which by WSJT is a pretty potent signal, so therefore you don't have to send the message a zillion times, how long does it take for a full message to appear on that screen, the full set of call letters, the signal strength report, and eventually the Rogers, let's not talk about the Rogers, to appear on that screen to get the N2MBS3 on that screen? I think that appears in 30 seconds. So you're transmitting data quite a bit faster than you're describing right now, Barry. Go ahead.
Okay, so in 30 seconds or 15. And it might be 15, actually. But that's still a long time.
Wait for the beep.
It's a long time by high-speed Morse code characteristics, but many of the guys sending moon bounce by human operator Morse code, you don't want to go too slow because your dots, your dashes get broken up, so to speak, by the moon's crazy in-phase, out-of-phase characteristics on a millisecond basis. There's an ideal speed for the average guy. I'm guessing the ideal moon bounce speed for a skilled operator, would you say it's in the vicinity of 10 words a minute of Morse code? Barry, go ahead. Wait for the beep.
Okay. Let me give a couple of seconds of thought. I would say it's about 10 words a minute. Yeah. Depends on the signal strength. You know, if things get really crummy, they would slow down. Now, the thing is, when you listen to the tones, and you can listen to the tones going out and coming, you know, you can hear them. They take a long time, and I think this is all a matter of timing. In other words, they know when to expect tone number two and how long that tone is supposed to be there. So if it breaks up a few times during the transmission, that doesn't matter.
To send your call letters, N2MB, that's four objects, S3, six objects, spaces in between. I think I'm going to agree with you. That whole message is easily sent in 15 seconds. So you're saying each one of those tone combinations, each character, the combination of tones, whether 1, 2, 3, and 4 are on in some particular combination, and it's held for one particular character period, you're saying it's in the vicinity of 1 or 2 seconds, and I think I'm going to agree with that. And the exact timing, in other words, the clocks are set sufficiently accurately set on both ends that you know exactly when the tone should begin and when the tone should end for that particular character. And you know when the next character is being sent, and maybe there's a little bit of dead time in between. And I'm also going to guess that the system in the very beginning of the transmission probably transmits all four tones for a period of time so that the receiver gets a chance to adapt itself to get to the nearest 10 hertz or 3 hertz, whatever it is, of frequency accuracy. I am guessing that the digital signal processing system, after you've done some coarse tuning to set the frequencies right, I am guessing it does some fine tuning because I think it's trying to set the filter on each one of those tones to the nearest 3 hertz or so in frequency accuracy. So I'll bet you it starts off transmitting the tones as a learning process for the rest of the receiving process. That's a guess on my part. N2MB, wait for the beeps, K2LAW.
Hey, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Listen to 375 and tell me it's too loud.
Stand by. Give me some audio.
Let me switch over to 85. Stand by.
I just listened to you on 375, and you sound approximately the right volume, Eric.
That's because I was transmitting on 375. Now I'm transmitting on 85.
375 is a little bit loud, slightly distorted. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I thought. All right. I'm going to have to crank it down a little bit. I'm going to back up to this. All right, continue.
You must like living there.
No, I don't. I should be working on my house.
What a dedicated guy. So, in your reading about WSJT, is there a learning curve by which you set the frequency of the receiver as close as you can get with human hearing, but then I'm guessing the adaptive computer program does a little bit further adapting beyond that? And in other words, a small amount of change in the Doppler shift, I think the system can accommodate. That's a guess on my part. I wonder if you've seen any operation or any words that suggests that's possibly accurate. N2 Moonbounce, K2LAW.
Okay, no, I don't think it's done that way. I think the receiver is tolerant of all four tones being skewed. In other words, they could all be upscale or downscale. But as long as they're in the right sequence, it accepts them as the individual tones. I think it's doing it that way. It's not locking up on it, actually. The other thing, there was something else in there. Let me think now. Okay. That was one problem. Right. When the first part of the transmission, your receiver, your computer, if you will, is trying to sync up on the timing of those tones, so that when the rest of the transmission comes along, it knows I'm to stop now, I'm to start looking, there's going to be a moment in between, I'm going to look for the next tone. So it like syncs up your receiver.
Yeah, I think all digital modes require some precise timing to get maximum benefit. I know we've spent a little bit too much time on this particular letter of yours, John. However, Moonbounce, to many guys who haven't really been there, is such a fascinating subject. It is such a deep subject that really pushes the state of the art of all of the communication system: antenna, feed line, transmitter, receiver, low noise amplifier, demodulation, modulation techniques, timing, clocks, geometry of the Earth and Moon system, right ascension, declination, calculations. What's the background of the moon? Is it the quiet part of the universe or the noisy part of the universe? Where's the sun? There's a lot of stuff involved. So it's a deep subject, but I therefore think a fair number of people interesting are probably like the particular subject, and maybe it justified us giving us four times as much time as we should have. KC2WGB, sorry about that. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Oh, that's perfect, Dick. No, that was fine. It just goes to show this gentleman that, there's a lot to it. I don't think he's going to have much success, but he could use them for DXing if he puts them up and get into that, and maybe make some sky searches and see what kind of noise he could find out there. I'm sure he could do a lot of interesting things with it, but I think it's beyond his capabilities right now to do anything productive with it. But it's so late, I think we should drop the rest and pick up Paul and see what happens.
If Paul's available, we're going to find that out real soon. By the way, four Yagis with a good low noise amplifier listening to the other Moonbounce signals, as long as you're doing it during one of the Moonbounce operating weekends, during one of the contests, he will hear signals. Only the big guns, but some of those big guns.
Time of the month is the most important thing. Actually, tonight is one of the best nights.
Because the moon is at perigee. When the moon is as close as you can get to the Earth, you get the minimum insertion loss. And if it's one of these operating periods, like this particular weekend is probably one of the big weekends that they intend to intentionally use, and if you know when to listen and what frequency to listen for the big guns, I'm convinced that four good Yagis, will allow him to hear a certain number of the big guns. What's your opinion on that one, Barry? You've been there. N2 Moonbounce, KQRIW, wait for the beep.
Well, I am very convinced with the new modes, like WSJT, this fellow that was asking that question, he probably will have results. I know that people are using single Yagis in 100 watts on 2 meters, just one band of reference, and they're having success. So that is quantum leaps from what we were doing 20 years ago.
A crazy question, Barry. Is one of your front teeth giving you a little bit of grief? Your voice sounds very slightly different, but maybe it's my earphones. Over to you, Barry.
No, you're right. I have a chip in my, you know, where your two front teeth come together, a little chip. You can't see it so much from the front, but if you put your finger back there, you can feel it in the back. So if you looked at my teeth, you might not notice it, but you can hear it.
I thought I was hearing it. WS2N, if you're there, Paul, K2RIW in the tech net.
Way ahead, Dick. I didn't check in earlier. A little confusing with the repeater, but way ahead, Dick. So, not too much, but we could just really two topics.
Yeah, I think these guys delayed the launch one more time. There was a very nice set of news reports over the last few days about this launch that's going to take place, and some nice interviews of those people took place, and they look like they had a pretty big operation there, essentially right at the NASA site as I see it. So what's the latest, Paul, of the S2N with our space report, K2RAW, and wait, and try not to forget once every 60 seconds ago or so to wait, give an interruption. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, they delayed it until the 19th. Last time I talked to John during the week, they didn't have a date set. I talked to WGB and I told him, well, I don't know, it don't look good. But then I think yesterday they came up with a date. So they have software problems. And they'd rather be safe than sorry. It'll be daytime launch. Don't want to Florida from and so one documentary where they're splicing all these wires and they're using heat shrink tubing and everything and on the ground, and these are not government workers. These, you know, I mean, they're working on a site, the, you know, government site and a NASA site, but these guys were all private company building the infrastructure for this whole thing, and you see the big four towers surrounding it, lightning towers, probably about 400 feet high, and that's where this thing takes off. Let me drop it.
Well, what are they using for a propellant?
Yeah, this is like similar to what the Russians use, liquid oxygen, but they're using a kerosene, a rocket fuel kerosene, and they use it in all their stages. Spacecraft itself is called the Dragon. The rocket, again, built by SpaceX, called the Falcon. It's called the Falcon 9. And they get the 9 for the 9 rocket boosters, Barry. You know, each booster is exactly the same. They're cross-fueled, so if one has a problem, you know, if you're low on fuel, it all gets made up by the other one. In the future, they're going to have booster rockets on the side that are going to do the same thing. That's unique. After it separates and you have a second stage, you have the same rocket. Again, liquid oxygen, kerosene, it's a single rocket for the second stage. And that's how they're going to do that, Barry.
And how much of this stuff is recoverable after the launch? You know, the rocket parts.
Well, if you read the SpaceX site and the you know, you look at the videos. Right now, the Dragon itself will be recoverable. It'll go up to the International Space Station, dock with that, using the Canadian robot arm 2 on the space station number 2, because number 1 was the one that was put on the space shuttle. So this thing's attached to the space station. It'll get close to it, it'll grab it, dock with it. It's a 21-day mission. We'll spend all that time up there and eventually deorbit. And unlike the Progress and the H2 by Japan and the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle by the European Space Agency, this thing is going to come back whole and be reusable. It's going to land in the Pacific Ocean. They've done this before. They've done 2 orbits, and they landed exactly right where they wanted to back in December of 2010. Let me drop it. I believe it was, I think it was 2011, the end of last year. So, that's the story. And it'll be reusable. In the future, the Falcon 9 itself will come back. Doesn't need a heat shield or anything. It'll be, you know, that won't go into orbit, but it will come back, and it's got all kinds of retro rockets on it. It's going to have one of these rockets fire and actually land. So we'll see if they can do that in a year or two. And then after that, the second stage itself, when that separates from the spacecraft, that will be in orbit, and they plan on bringing that back, Barry. So that's got a heat shield on it. It'll enter the atmosphere, do a 180, come back down and land as well, drop it. We've covered this before in the TechNet, Barry, but you missed it there. So it's worth repeating that the Dragon spacecraft is a cargo vehicle, 1,200 pounds to the space station, food, water, supplies, fuel, and then it will bring back 1,200 pounds of scientific equipment. It will be the only vehicle to go up and be able to bring stuff down, outside of a little bit that they could put inside the Soyuz spacecraft when they bring the 3 astronauts back at a time. Interesting thing, in the future, this Dragon will be convertible. You'll be able to carry up to 7 astronauts to the space station and bring them back. Or you might be able to bring, let's say, 3 astronauts up and, you know, a whole bunch of cargo. It's got a pressurized area, and it's got a non-pressurized area. Let me drop it. WS2N, and it's got solar panels that are going to come out on this flight. Last flight, they didn't have that. This flight, they need to demonstrate that they've got solar panels that pop out to give it, you know, extra power. So, a lot of testing that's going to be going on during this flight. This is actually considered a demonstration flight, even though it's going up to the space station. Last one worked out so good that NASA said we don't need any more, you know, other suborbital flights or orbital flights not going to the space station. This is good enough. Let's go. Let's try it. So that's the status on the Dragon and the Falcon. And the new date is on the 19th of this month. So we'll see. Let me drop it. And I also want to mention that the Enterprise spacecraft that wound up now in Kennedy Airport eventually will wind up at the museum, the Intrepid, down in the Battery. That a lot of people, you know, and it did had quite a few missions on top of the 747. A lot of people think that, well, this thing just goes from, you know, they put it on the 747 to bring it somewhere. Well, that's true, they do, but in the beginning, Enterprise rode on top of the 747, and they originally just landed it with the 747. As time went on, they had two crews that would alternate and fly this thing. It would separate from the 747 over New Mexico and White Sands, and it would come down and land in the salt bed, you know, not on the runway. We drop it. So they actually did four flights like that. This guy Hayes and Fullerton, they were the first ones to fly it, and then Engel and Truly would fly it. And they would alternate, and then the next flight, Hayes and Fullerton would go, and back and forth it went. But they actually had five decoupling flights where Enterprise would separate and land and, on the salt flat, so actually salt bed in New Mexico. The final flight, the fifth flight, they actually landed the thing on the runway. And that was it. Then it was okay. After that, the Columbia was built, finished, and put through its test run. These flights, Enterprise, went up in 1977, and the regular Columbia didn't go up until about 1981. So that's the history. It's pretty good. Grumman here on Long Island built the wing for all of these things. We drop it. As we fly over Long Island, you know, when I came up from Washington, D.C., kept my camera on me. You know, they didn't say where the flight was going to go, you know, the flight path. All they said it was going to go down the Hudson River and over the Statue of Liberty. Well, I figured I had to get up to the Hudson River somehow. I was hoping it was going to go over Long Island, Connecticut, but it didn't. If it did, I don't know where it did. You know, maybe out by Montauk, or who knows where it went. Or maybe even inland. I never did find out. So that's the story on Enterprise, the patch that they have, the first mission patch. I have a copy of that on a computer showing Hayes, Fulton, England, Truly on that patch, but they kept flying it over and over again. So that's really the first mission patch for any of the shuttles and drivers. People don't realize also the Enterprise, was actually, they put the solid booster rocket attached to it and everything. They used it as a template. They put it on the launch pad down at Cape Kennedy before Columbia was built, make sure everything was okay. I mean, they rolled it out to the pad on the crawler and all. And then as time went by, they were eventually going to fly these missions out of California as well. So we would have manned missions from Florida and manned missions from California, from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Well, that never happened, but all the infrastructure, the launch site, everything was built. The O2 tanks, liquid hydrogen tanks, everything was built out there. It spent billions of dollars ready for manned missions, mostly military type of flights by the shuttle. Drop. Okay, let the commercial go by. And then what they did is they actually took Enterprise and put the tanks on, boosters and all, and they did the same thing. They put it on the pad out in Vandenberg Air Force Base. And I have a nice vocal picture of that. I guess you can find that on the internet as well. And there it sat, and it looked good. And then Challenger happened, and they decided not to do this manned missions from Vandenberg. And that was all canceled. So that's the history of the Enterprise. It stayed at our museum down at our Smithsonian all these years. And now it's up here in New York. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
One last question, Paul, and that is, of all the hardware that SpaceX is going to be sending up, does all of it get recovered, or does some of it get sacrificed? Like maybe the very first stage of the booster, does that get sacrificed?
They're going to recover it in the Atlantic, but in the future, and they're talking a couple of years, the first stage will be reusable. They'll bring it back. It will land vertically on Earth. It's unbelievable. Second stage as well. A couple of years after that, that's a little bit more difficult because that has to deorbit. It needs its own electronics. And it needs its own retro rockets. And it needs its own maneuvering rockets, thrusters, you know, hydrazine rockets all over to you know, actually travel in space, readjust itself. A little bit more difficult there. And then, of course, the Dragon spacecraft itself with cargo and eventually with up to 7 astronauts designed right now to go back and forth to space station only. Back to you, Dick.
And another question is that you told us a couple of weeks ago that SpaceX intends to eventually tool up to how many launches per year are they thinking they're eventually going to get to? Paul, go ahead.
They want to go with 12 launches per year. In fact, they already have a contract, you know, money allocated by the government. Right now, NASA is their prime payer. But yeah, 12 launches. And in the future, they have something called the Dragon Lab. Private corporations might want to pay Dragon to launch experiments into space, not going to the space station. So they're equipped for that, which will have astronauts on this thing with a different experiment called Dragon Lab. And then that would be more flights. But they're planned. Number is 12. There.
Good project. What's your best guess, Paul, as to when anybody else other than SpaceX will also be doing launches? There are other people tooling up. Are they a year behind or even more? Over to you, Paul.
Orbital Sciences has the spacecraft built almost. That's probably a couple of years away. Looks like a little space shuttle. It'll be mounted on top of a rocket. And they're not building their own rocket. That will be launched on top of an Atlas V, you know, a regular government NASA rocket. And as far as I know, that was the latest prediction. And that's called the Dream Chaser. That's under development. We'll carry up to 7 astronauts. The good thing about that, you know, everybody says, oh, we'll never see another space shuttle again. Well, you won't, but go to the space station dock, then deorbit, and bring up the 7 astronauts back. Now, this thing's going to come down and land on wheels, land on a runway, any runway. It won't need this big, you know, 3-mile runway like the shuttle needed, whatever it was, 3 miles. It'll have, instead of the tiles, it'll have similar material, but made in big sections. It's not going to be like the shell had, 44,000 different little tiles on it or something like that. This thing's going to have, you know, like one section for the wing, another section for another wing, another one for the fuselage, and, big difference. Back to you, Dave.
Too bad there isn't some kind of a way that all of the booster couldn't have been put behind the shuttle, in which case anything falling off the booster and its cryogenic tank wouldn't have a chance to hit the shuttle. So with a slight change in the way you mount the booster, but I know that's an awful big change. The SpaceX is using kerosene plus oxygen. I am guessing that kerosene is a little bit lower in energy content compared to liquid hydrogen. The shuttle used liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and of course they got them into the gaseous form before they shoved them into the chamber. But I'm guessing that kerosene is a lot easier fuel to deal with. That's the good news. But I'm guessing you get a little bit less energy out of it. Is that true, Paul? KQLIW.
As far as I know, hydrogen is probably the most powerful and cleanest fuel. You know, it mean, look at a vapor trail that came out of the shuttle. You know, that was really nothing but steam. You know, that liquid hydrogen mixing with liquid oxygen. You know, was very powerful. But certain advantages to using this, they don't need a separate hydraulic system. You know, the shuttle had independent hydraulics for, you know, gimballing and moving things around on the booster. This thing is actually going to use the, it's kind of weird, but they're going to use the fuel, the kerosene as, you know, part of the hydraulics to make things move. Keeps the cost down. You don't need a separate APUs. They call them APUs. automatic propulsion units, I think. Three of them, and if any one of them was down, it was okay, but if two went down, then it was an abort. But this don't have any of that, so there's certain differences, certain pros and cons. SpaceX has really thought things out from what I see there. WS
joint.
Yeah, APU is an auxiliary power unit. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I know the first fuels are hypergolic. If they go to the second fuel, the hydrazine, is that also hypergolic?
Hydrazine and nitric acid, which is used on some of the missiles, are hypergolic. They explode on contact. In the case of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, you've got to give it a spark. You've got to initiate it. It's not hypergolic. Kerosene and liquid oxygen, to my knowledge, are not hypergolic. You've got to give it a spark. So I wonder if you've seen that sparking device they've got around the shuttle before the launch to make sure that there's no excess gases floating around that are willing to explode. And I think all of that sparking is done to make doubly sure that the flame in the nozzle, in the rocket engine, is ignited. So I think they have to supply a spark when they put kerosene and liquid oxygen into that chamber. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
Yes, as far as I know, with kerosene. First time I remember reading about those type of engines that would mix the fuels together and they would ignite with LEM and land on the moon. They wanted that. They wanted a situation where, you know, you didn't need a spark of any kind. I mean, the fuels mixed together, and they were gone. They wanted that as simple as possible. To this day, they keep using it for different various things. John said. So, yeah. It's going to say something about the rocket cells, fuel. What was it? I don't know. It went out of my head.
Don't think of it. Any other questions, John? And we could go to another letter. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
WV2U with an Enterprise sighting.
WV2U. I should know you, but go right ahead with your Enterprise sighting. Start with your name, sir.
Thank you, Dick. My name here is Paul. And the shuttle was visible here in Seaford. It was flying from east to west, of course, headed to Kennedy. And what was most unusual was the sound the engines were making. At first, I was kind of like, hey, that's a passenger jet. But I guess they had the engines really cranked up to the max. But, yes, it was visible.
I think we lost Paul.
Yeah, I think we did. WV2U, I think that was. And he's located in Seaford, sure enough. And he's talked to us before, but I think he's using a handy. His signal got very weak. Maybe the battery had dropped out.
Dick, KC2QIQ.
Glenn.
I could actually copy him here on the input, and basically what he was saying was that he viewed the shuttle along the coastline, going along basically the area of Jones Beach. I just wanted to forward that over to you. KC2QIQ, back to you, Dick.
I think he also told us that the engines were really cranked up and were very loud because of all of the extra weight and drag of the shuttle. You've got, probably close to 250,000 pounds of shuttle sitting on top of that poor airplane, so I think those engines really have to crank to keep that thing flying. I think that's what he was saying. Is that true, Glenn?
Yes, he was, and he was also making a comment about a strange sound it was making, apparently something not similar to what I guess a normal jet in this area would sound like. Back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I guess on my part is the wind whistling past the shuttle combined with the wind whistling past the 747, which is its transport, and the 747 is at not a maximum load, but a very heavy load, and it's slow flying alongside of Long Island. That combination is going to make some pretty weird sounds, is the best guess. One other thing I ought to tell you guys is that...
Hello, Dick.
Hello, Eric.
Smith Center, Center on 375.
Roger, Dodger, stand by.
K2RIW testing. My first guess is that the audio from 375 into 85 is a bit low, and you're raising it right now. It's making it sound good. When I was listening to about Paul transmitting on 25 coming out on 375, his audio, after you readjusted it, was approximately right. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Keep talking.
Okay, I'll keep talking. So that the main thing I want to tell you guys is that when you go to the TechNet website, amateurradio.tanglevictor, that particular first page has an error, and it, for the last week or so, it doesn't load. So you can go to the next page, even though the first page will not load, and you get to the next page by using a slightly longer website address, www.amateurradio.tangovictor/technet/.
Okay.
All right, listen to 375, tell me what you think.
Okay, stand by. First of all, you want me to transmit on 25 and listen to 375, is that what you want me to do?
Yeah, I want you to listen to 375. You want to transmit on 25, go right ahead.
Okay, I'm transmitting on 25 right now, and as you listen on 375, my audio is just a skosh low by standards. Eric, go ahead.
All right, I can raise it a little bit.
Hello, 1234. Hello, 1234. Yeah, 375, when I'm transmitting on 25, is about 3 or 4 dB low, in my opinion. Hello, 1234. That's too loud. That's too loud. That's too much. Okay, come on down a few dB. Keep coming down, Eric. KE2EJ, this is K2RIW. IW running a test. And that audio is still, that's now a little bit too low. There's got to be a place in between there, Eric. A little bit louder. I'd say a little bit louder. You're just about there. Yes. I think you're there. Stand by while I check command the two. I'm now listening to myself on 85, and I'm listening to myself on 375. And 375, I'm about a dB lower. Maybe 2 dB lower. That's about right now. I think you've got it. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, yeah, looks good out of me to 2. K2RIW, KE2EJ. Okay, now I've got one little last problem that doesn't concern you. All right, keep going. I'll bug you again when I need you. K2RIW, KE2EJ.
Okay, so as I was saying, when people go to the website where you can listen to past TechNet audios, right now, the very first page has some kind of an error where it will not load. It's been that way for a good portion of a week. So you're going to go to the second page where you can listen to at least this year's worth,
It's www.amateurradio.tangovictor, that's the same, /technet, T-E-C-H-N-E-T, /index 2012, A-L-L dot H-T-M. So there's no punctuation in that last section there. Tango Victor /technet /, and now all of this has no punctuation. INDEX2012ALL.HTM. You go to that complete website address, and you'll be looking at the second page. You'll be looking at all of the index for the year 2012, and therefore you can listen to the TechNet even though the first page doesn't load. And that could save you some grief. Another buddy of mine had another website error somewhat like that. Some kind of changes are happening these days. Okay, do you want to go to another?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Paul. You thought of what you were forgetting?
Yes, the other day I was speaking to John, KC2WGB, and he was commenting about the sound of the shuttle as it went over Staten Island. So he could comment. I'm sure he could make a comment on that. It was around that point that I lost him. We lost contact, but I don't know what happened after that. Back to you, then.
Hey, John, tell us what the shuttle sounded like when it passed it over Todd Hill, Staten Island, the county of Richmond. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. Actually, I saw it was sort of at the narrows over the water area. It was not traveling very fast, but the Fowler flaps were down, and he really had the throttle up, but he was not going very quickly. But you could hear that thing laboring. And I don't know the specific noise that we're talking about out in Long Island, but you could hear a rhythmic whirring. You notice when they're coming over to land in Kennedy, when they change the flap configuration and throttles, here it go from that that makes that funny noise. He was making that type of noise the entire time he was traveling lateral from me.
Now, once again, the difference in the noise that you normally hear, was it the kind of sound that you hear when reverse thrust is being applied on the ground? Try to describe the difference in the sound that you heard. Over to you, John.
Sounded like the engine tuning or the resonance of the engine was changing because of the position of the throttle and the way the Fowler flaps were configured. I think he was trying to keep enough lift on the plane. I think you made the right conclusion. The airflow from the shuttle and the airflow over the wings were probably modulating that tone.
Keith. I'm going to interrupt you for a minute.
Glenn recognized. We'll pick you up in a minute. Looks like we're back to normal operation. Is that true, Paul? I meant Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW, are we back to normal or should I stand by? I'm going to guess we're back to nearly normal operations. Go ahead with your message, Glenn.
I guess it was just a comment, Dick, that I'd seen photographs of the shuttle configuration with the 747. And one thing that struck me as being odd is that on the tail section, they had some kind of like vertical flaps on the end of the side of the tail wings, the tail wing or that whole tail assembly. That's very, very different from a standard 747. So I'm wondering if that even has some audible effect to it, because normally that those trips we've never seen really the shuttle fly in this part of the country. And, so maybe it was normal to hear that kind of sound all the time, but just even that tail section just looks so strange. I'm wondering if you've ever seen that, Dick. K2RIW, D62QIQ.
Glenn, they've had the tail section like that since the beginning, since the earliest flights of the Enterprise 77.
Yeah, it reminds me of the so-called Super Constellation, which was a shuttle airplane in roughly,
1964-65 time frame. That was flying shuttle from New York to Washington, and it had a triple tail. They'd had to add two more vertical stabilizers to have enough rudder authority. The reason for that is that when you put the space shuttle in the right position on the 747, so the center of gravity of one is in the right place for the center of gravity of the other, you've got a hell of a lot of stuff on the shuttle that sticks out forward. And as such, if you didn't add extra area to the vertical stabilizer, the 747 would have a slight tendency to want to turn around backwards because of all the stuff on the shuttle that is forward of the center of lift. There's a whole lot of nose sticking out in front of the shuttle as far as the 747 is concerned. So they had to go to a triple tail to have enough authority. And I don't know if all three of them are rudders that move, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they do. Now back to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
KC2ZVT.
Yeah, ZVT recognized. That, you know, it's funny, though. It raises the question, I wonder if that 747 can fly with that without the shuttle on it. I would imagine it could, but it was just something that I've never seen it fly, but it is interesting seeing the photographs of it and noticing that that tail assembly. But I'm going to pass back to you, Dick, and pick up the other station, I guess, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, they used to fly all the time. They used to drop it, release the shuttle, and then the 747 would land by itself.
Yeah, the 747, any airplane you put extra rudder on it, extra vertical stabilizer, if anything, it's more stable. You can never have too much vertical stabilizer, so I guarantee it'll fly like a charm. Pete, KC2ZVT, hopefully you're an aerodynamicist, you're going to give us more information. You've got it, Pete.
KC2ZVT, no, I'm an old pilot and haven't flown in years, but I think the reason they have the additional stabilizers is because with the shuttle on the back, it disrupts the airflow past the vertical stabilizer. I saw it fly over Long Beach twice. I was beautifully lined up on 3-1, and it came in beautifully over Long Beach twice. He did touch and go and took off the first time and went around, flew over the Atlantic, and then came back in again. I got some beautiful pictures.
Yeah, I think I heard you wrong. It's a Zebra Bravo Tango. You're Lou in New Jersey. Is that true, Lou?
No, Zulu Victor Tango.
Okay, so I had it right the first time. How about that? Huh. So therefore, you are Pete in Garden City. So I don't think there's any airplane that if you add extra vertical stabilizer, which is one of the things that Kelly Johnson had to do on a number of aircraft, particularly on the Super Connie, that's not bad. To have too little vertical stabilizer control, particularly if you ever lose an engine, my goodness, you're in trouble. In fact, the most dangerous thing I can think of is a four-engine airplane taking off. You've gotten to V2, you've done the rollout, and you're lifting off the runway, and two engines die on one side. If that happens, I think you might not have anywhere near enough rudder authority to keep that airplane flying. I wonder if you've ever studied a situation like that, Pete. KC2ZBT, K2RIW.
KC2ZBT. I have taken some lessons in a Cessna 310, which is a twin engine. And you do have to, whether it's two engines or four engines, it doesn't matter. Once you lose the engines on one side, you have to compensate tremendously with the rudder. And all planes are built to be able to land with that kind of configuration. But with the shuttle, that was definitely because they have it's so much distortion of the airflow along the vertical stabilizer. They had to put those additional stabilizers on the side. And the sound that it made coming in over Long Beach just sounded just like where you were traveling at low speed and high engine RPM with full flaps.
So I guess you could say they were slow. What we were hearing is the sound of slow flying. In other words, probably 90% thrust capability with Fowler flaps deployed. Is that approximately it, Pete?
Yeah, it's affirmative. It sounds correct.
Now, from one point of view, that is a slightly dangerous condition. By that I mean, He didn't have a whole lot of altitude. He didn't have a whole lot of airspeed. With those Fowler flaps out there, he's creating a hell of a lot of drag. If in that configuration he loses thrust of one or two engines, he's got to make a lot of compensation in a hurry, otherwise things start getting real bad real fast. What do you think, Pete?
Well, that's something you practice for when you're when you're taking lessons and you're learning how to fly. You go up over Jones Beach, further a little bit further east, go up to about 3,000 feet, get into that kind of configuration with high flaps and high engine, and keep pulling back on the nose until she tips over. And hopefully you got a good instructor.
I hear you. You're pushing your luck on that one. And one of the things that happens now, when you lose the engine on one side of a multi-engine aircraft, there's a speed at which the airplane will fly below under normal conditions. But in the case of losing the engine on one side, there's a much higher speed you must stay above in order to have enough rudder authority. You go below that number where, in theory, you've got enough velocity to fly. You don't have enough rudder authority to overcome the yaw created by the thrust on one side. And you could lose it. And I think in that situation, the only recovery is to dive to get up enough airspeed where you can get back the authority on that vertical stabilizer. I presume that's a practice procedure that's required on a multi-engine aircraft. Is that true, Pete? KC2ZVT, K2RIW?
KC2ZVT. I can't really say because I didn't get that far before I stopped flying. You know, it became a matter of, do I want to pay the mortgage, or do I want to eat, or do I want to fly?
WA2ZOZ.
WA2ZOZ. Start off with your name and your comments, sir.
Good evening, everyone. Handle here is Don Delta Oscar November, located in Norwood, New Jersey. I have a comment and a question. I was listening to the news when the shuttle was flying over Statue of Liberty, and they said that even though the shuttle is very heavy, it does not present the same weight. It presents less weight than if the plane, all the seats were fully populated and the cargo hold was filled with the passengers' cargo. And also, the shuttle, even though the engines are off, the wings still have lift. So I would think that the supports going to the 747, I'm sure they have to compensate for that also. And the gentleman was saying, let me drop it. Okay, the gentleman was saying, I believe from Garden City, when the combination shuttle and aircraft were flying over, he heard the engines really start to wind up. And, well, I guess they lost lift on the shuttle wings, so that's when more weight came into play. And my question is, I'm sure other aircrafts could not be in the area when the shuttle and 747 were in the area. I was just wondering if anyone knows how big the no-fly zone at that time, like how many miles in diameter would it be in the fly zone. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone on frequency is going to know that. I just did a back of the envelope calculation. I made a very rough guess, and I could be wrong, assuming that a 747 can hold 350 passengers, assuming each passenger is 200 pounds, a little on the heavy side. That 70,000 pounds total gives them another 50,000 pounds for cargo, possible cargo. That's a pure guess on my part. And we're up to I think it's 120,000 pounds total, and therefore it's still considerably less than the weight of a shuttle. I think a shuttle is close to 250,000 pounds when it's empty. The good news is it's got some lift to it. It's not just pure weight. On top of that, this modified 747, they probably removed all of the seats and a hell of a lot of other stuff that's normally in the fuselage. So I think in the big picture, I think the 747 is getting close to its max payload capability. And I'll bet you they don't give it a full load of fuel. In other words, the 747 can make international flights. I'll bet you they don't put anywhere near that amount of fuel on board when they're flying from California to Florida or vice versa. So I don't think there's a whole lot left over of payload capability on that 747 when it's leaving the runway. When you're at full airspeed and the shuttle is now giving you some lift, life gets a lot simpler. So if an emergency...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
CUS to one. KC2QIQ with a comment.
Paul and Glenn in that order. If an emergency is being declared, it really like the landing pattern at Kennedy to be wide open so that they could go straight in. That's a guess on my part. Paul, go ahead, KQLIW.
Yeah, we had this topic the other day, but I never did find out the total range with the shuttle on top, but I do know that every time they landed in Edwards in California and they had to bring the shuttle back to Florida, they could not make it in one trip. They had to stop somewhere in White Sands or in Texas or somewhere. It was always a stopover. They couldn't make the 3,000 miles. But.
So that's a pretty strong piece of evidence saying that a full load of fuel would have brought them brought maximum payload. KC2QIQ, KQRIW.
Actually, Dick, I know I read this a while ago, but a couple of different things I knew about the 747 is that the 747's capability of carrying payload isn't just the passengers. As a matter of fact, the plane's capability is to carry more, in other words, the weight of the luggage and the additional cargo that they carry on board on each flight. Because apparently they not only just carry luggage, they also carry other things on board for deliveries and other things, believe it or not, on board the plane. So actually the payload and the luggage actually weighs more than the passengers. So there's a lot of payload capacity on a 747 that probably well exceeds the weight problem with the shuttle. That's probably one of the main reasons they went for a 747. But the fuel capacity is a serious problem because of all that drag hanging off the top. That thing's a big pimple up there. And I believe that probably the fuel range capability when they do that is really, really bad. But back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Dick?
Yeah, John recognized the size of the wing and the thrust of the engines on a B-1 bomber and a 747 are in the same ballpark in my mind before I start looking it up and really checking. A B-1 bomber is capable of 150,000 pounds of payload. I worked on that airplane. And whether or not that's a full load of fuel, I'm not sure. We just calculated 70,000 pounds for the passengers. If it's 150,000 pounds total payload, that gives you, what, another 90,000 or something like that, 80,000. Yeah, another 80,000 pounds of cargo plus luggage. KC2WGB, K2LAW. Go ahead, John.
I think the passenger load and cargo, fully fueled, the range is 13,000 miles. So if you take that and you get, what, a half a million pounds of fuel, I think it takes to fill it.
Wow. Half a million pounds of fuel. Got a guess as to what the maximum payload can be? I think you said max payload of luggage plus other stuff plus passengers and half a million pounds of fuel. Something's wrong here. The reason I say that is total weight of a 747 heavy is approximately 750,000 pounds total. I'm going to guess the empty aerof-